From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, we talk with astronomer and astrophysicist David Latham about the ongoing search for life off Earth and the kinds of planets we need to find that could support it. Then one local teenager's experience with Rosalie Manor's positive parenting program helps her do her best for herself and her daughter.
It really came down to, I have a child. There's no way I can have a minimum wage job and still do everything I need to do for her and for me. So I have to go to school. I have to get a degree so I can make more money.
We'll learn about a book that features letters home to Wisconsin during the Civil War, and the very funny but unpredictable play Art opens at the Milwaukee Chamber Theater.
It's not set up where, like, you just know exactly where all the laugh lines are, and you kind of can predict the audiences. It's really, I think, going to hit different audiences in different ways.
Stay tuned for Lake Effect, but first the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company this morning. Any successful search for extraterrestrial life that is similar to that here on Earth requires finding planets outside of our solar system that could support it. There are many thousands of planets within observable distance to the Earth, but most of these exoplanets don't have the requisite Earth-like properties to sustain carbon-based life forms. Dr. David Latham is leading a team at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics that's confirming the existence of exoplanets that are similar to Earth. He was also in Milwaukee in April to give the 8th Annual COIN Lecture in Astronomy and Astrophysics at Marquette University, and he stopped by the Lake Effect studio then to explain how his specific research fits into the greater search for Earth-like planets.
I like to say that we live at a very special time in the history of astronomy. We are poised to find planets enough like the Earth that we could imagine them being comfortable for life as we know it. I don't mean the giant planets, the gas giants like Jupiter, which are big and easy to detect and characterize. I'm talking about small planets, ones that might be rocky, could have surfaces, could have water on the surface if they are at the right distance from their host star, so the temperature could be right, the water could be liquid. There could be secondary atmospheres. The original atmosphere of light gases like hydrogen and helium have blown away and been replaced by more interesting atmospheres with molecules like water and carbon dioxide, the kind of material you need for, I call it, the invention of life. And we're very close to being able to do that, to identify, discover, and even characterize such planets. And hopefully do spectroscopy of their atmospheres so we can learn what kind of an atmosphere they have. There's even some hope that someday we should be able to detect molecules that are the product of life. If there's enough life, such as we have here on Earth, to influence the biosphere, create molecules of gases that we could detect, then by remote sensing we could see if there are signs of life on those planets. So that's the long-range picture I have.
Which is just fantastic, even though in our lifetimes it's unlikely we could ever get to any of those planets once they're identified. But just knowing they're out there and that there might be other beings doing similar things that we are.
Yes, it's the great question. Are we alone?
Right now, I'm assuming that the work you're doing is looking for characteristics that we would recognize as life. Is that correct?
Well, that's the easiest thing to do. It's like the drunk looking for his keys under the lamppost. So we're starting by looking for life that is carbon-based chemistry and needs liquid water, we think. But actually, we have to consider a larger set of possibilities. And I'm part of an initiative called the Harvard Origins of Life Initiative, which is a multidisciplinary effort involving people studying how to make cells, biochemists, and astronomers. And the role of the astronomers is to characterize the sorts of planets that might be out there in our galaxy and to determine whether the atmospheres are like the ones we're used to in the solar system or whether there might be other global geochemistries. And the whole idea is to restrict the possibilities for these people trying to figure out how to make life by telling them something about the raw materials that they have to work with.
How do you look for something that we don't know what it looks like? If there is a different sort of life, what kind of markers would you maybe expect to see that you'd say, well, maybe this might be life, but it might not be life the way we think of life?
We're actually having enough trouble figuring out what molecules might be good markers for life as we know it. That's an area of very active research. And thinking of what would be markers for life that we don't understand the biochemistry for, that's kind of outside the box right now. We're trying to do the easy problem. But the first step is to find planets that are enough like the Earth that we might have a chance of finding signs of life, the kind of life that we know.
So as an astronomer, how do you do that? What tools do you use to find those planets?
Well, right now, all the action is in the study of transiting planets. These are planets that happen to pass between us and their star, so we see them blocking some light. And that gives us an idea of the size of the planet compared to the size of the star, because we see what fraction of the starlight is blocked. And if we can also measure the masses using the Doppler shift, Doppler velocities, radial velocities, then we have the mass and the size, and that gives us the bulk properties, for example, the density, because that depends just on mass and radius, and the surface gravity for that matter. And those are the planets where we are focusing our attention now. And the key tools are space missions, NASA space missions. One that's been in operation for 4 years now called the Kepler mission, been a very successful mission. And it is exploring the population of small planets. Its goal is to find out the frequency of Earth-like planets. It was built to do that job. It stares at just one area on the sky, 1/400th of the sky. So the next step after Kepler is another space mission called the Transiting Exoplanet Survey satellite. That'll survey the whole sky because undoubtedly Kepler has missed the nearest and brightest transiting planets. And those will be the primary targets for finding terrestrial-like planets, planets like the Earth, maybe bigger, easier to detect and characterize. And those are the ones where we hope that we might be able to study the atmospheres remotely.
Let's assume that everything happens as it's supposed to, and in 2017 the launch happens. How quickly will you begin getting data? Right away?
Right away, in the first month or two. The strategy is to cover the whole sky, and we do that with a set of 4 wide-angle cameras, and they stare at one part of the sky for a month. So we only find short-period planets, 10 or 20 days. So if they are orbiting a star like the Sun, they'll be much too hot for life. But if they're orbiting much smaller, cooler stars, then the zone where water could be liquid is much shorter, can be as short as a couple of weeks. Rather different from the year that you used to hear on the Earth. Annual year, yearly orbit would only be 2 weeks. So we'll get results pretty quickly, and they will be made public within 6 months so the whole community can work on the new candidates, the new bright nearby prime targets for studying transiting planets.
When you say nearby, how many light years are we talking?
Oh, well, they're still quite far away, 20, 50, even 100 light years away.
So, again, no real possibility of visiting any of them. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a long time before we send anybody to Alpha Centauri, the nearest star system. We might send probes there eventually, but it's not against the law of physics, but it may be against the law of economics. Will our society be interested in funding that kind of endeavor?
Are they fascinated enough to give money? I mean, I guess that's the big question, you know, to motivate governments to actually fund this kind of research.
Well, NASA astrophysics, which is all of astronomy and astrophysics supported by NASA, recently chose the test mission, an exoplanet mission. It was the only full mission that they chose in this particular round of competition that started 2 years ago. It's a long journey from the initial submission, 36 proposals in competition, down to 2 for the last year. Our concept study report went in last September, and There's a long process that leads to the selection of missions, and NASA is focused on exoplanets as one of the most interesting areas of science to support. And I think that's a reflection of the public interest.
David Latham, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and talking about this fascinating research, and best of luck with it all.
It was my pleasure.
Dr. David Latham is a senior astronomer at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory and is leading a team at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics that's researching for and confirming the existence of exoplanets with Earth-like characteristics. He was in Milwaukee this spring to give the 8th Annual COIN Lecture in Astronomy and Astrophysics at Marquette University, and our interview with him first aired in June. We'll take a short break now, and then stay tuned for more of Lake Effect coming your way in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. One of Milwaukee's biggest public health concerns is its high teen pregnancy rate. A number of years ago, after a report showed that Milwaukee was among the top cities for teen pregnancies, Mayor Tom Barrett and Health Commissioner Bevin Baker announced a citywide goal to reduce the rate by 46% by 2015. In the fall of last year, the city reported that the rate had dropped from 52 pregnancies per 1,000 girls in 2006 to 33.4 pregnancies per 1,000 girls in 2011. While these efforts show progress is being made toward the goal, there are other efforts to help and support the teen moms that are already out there. And that includes Rosalie Manor Community and Family Services. It's targeting a number of resources to help teen mothers through its Positive Parenting Program. That program, which has been around since 1908 as the Mother Care Program, pairs caseworkers with local teen moms to teach them parenting skills, provide financial and emotional support, encourage educational and career goals, and offer guidance towards becoming contributors to the community. Anna Hammernick is a graduate of that program who's become a teacher and school leader working in several different countries. But 18 years ago, she had just given birth to her daughter, Olivia, as a teenage mother. It was a happy but scary time, and she tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce how the program stepped in right when she needed a lot of support.
I was a little bit in denial when I first found out that I was pregnant. So it took about 4 or 5 months for me to go to the doctor and actually get that confirmed. And I remember my mom was in the car, and I still hadn't been confirmed, but she said, so when are you going to tell me you're pregnant? And I was like, just dead silence. So that sort of spurred me then to go to the doctor and find out. And I sort of thought I was, but you know, if you don't know for sure, then you can sort of still ignore it. So I think that's what I was doing when I was 17.
What was going through your mind in terms of once you got that confirmation? Did you really conceive how your life was going to change?
No way. I don't think there's any possible way to know what being a parent is like when you're 17.
What was your mom's reaction then, you know, once it was confirmed, and your family's reaction?
I think they were all very disappointed, you know, because I think all of the people that love you always see the potential that you have. And so when that sort of gets derailed, it hurts them because they know what's coming, but you as the person that's in it doesn't know what's coming. So I think they were very disappointed. But after the initial, oh my gosh, sets in and everybody's sort of over it, then you start getting ready for a baby. And then when the baby comes, you get excited because you have this brand new, gorgeous new baby and everybody's helping and everybody's supporting. And, you know, it sort of changes. So at first it's like, oh gosh, you know, she's going to be a mom and she's still 17. And then it's, wow, this baby is beautiful and we love her and we can't imagine her not being in our family.
Did you expect that you would get that support from your family? I mean, what's your dynamic there?
I don't know if I ever really considered that my family wouldn't support me. They've always been supportive of all of my adventures and everything that I've always done. Even as a kid, I went to space camp. You know, so I mean, they've always really encouraged me and loved me and wanted me to do the things that I wanted to do in my life. So I guess it never really occurred that they wouldn't support me. I didn't know how much they would support me. That was probably a big question. How much were they going to babysit and how much would they help me when I needed to write a paper or go do something? So that was probably a big question mark.
How did you come to learn about Rosalie Manor and the Mother Care Program, what's now called the Positive Parenting Program?
So I delivered at St. Francis Hospital. And while I was in the hospital room, Becky, who was a case manager at the time, just came into my room and introduced herself as being from Rosalie Manor, told me about the program and asked me if I was interested.
And what did she say that made you receptive to this right after having a baby.
I think there's one thing is any support you can get. Any support you can get is always going to be helpful. So if somebody is reaching out their hand to you and saying, here, you're in this situation, I'm going to help you, I can't imagine turning that down. So I don't remember her exact words, but she was willing to help me, and I was willing to take all the help that I could get. I knew it would be hard. I didn't know how hard, but I knew it would be hard, and I knew I would need everything that I could possibly get from other people to support me through this.
So what did you get from Rosalie Manor's positive parenting program? I mean, what resources were provided to you?
I have to say, like, probably the biggest and most important one that Becky gave was, like, she talked to me. And it wasn't talking to me as another adult or talking to me as one of my friends. It was sort of talking to me as a peer. And so it was different than the sort of support that I got from all the rest of the people, because she was a little older and wiser, but not too old and wise that I felt like she was telling me what to do. So I would ask her everything. I mean, I even remember at that point in time, she had gotten engaged, and I was just asking her about getting married and about how she found her husband. Just normal conversations with people. And I think that was what was really great about that relationship, is that I could really talk to her. But of course, they gave me lots of resources if I was low on diapers, if I needed formula, or if I just couldn't find a way to do something, if I needed a good doctor for my daughter. You know, it was just like all those things that you just don't know how to find or where to go to get things. I could easily just call Becky and say, hey, like, I'm not sure how to do this. Can you help me? So she would come over and we would go through things. She would help me with Olivia and the things that she was going through. I remember when she was starting to walk and wondering, is this when she's supposed to walk? Or, you know, when they start eating solid foods, is this when they're supposed to be doing these things? So it's just somebody to talk to about all of those baby-related things that's not preaching to you or just being your friend. They're really there to help.
Well, that seems like a really important element, this idea of not preaching, but rather being supportive and not talking at you, but talking with you.
Right, right.
What was it like, though, as you were learning how to be Olivia's mom, also being a teenager at the same time? I mean, that's a time when you're kind of forming your identity. And they always say that, you know, when you become a mom, that's your new identity. But I would imagine there's still a lot of mix of emotions when you're that age.
I don't really go for that argument that, like, as soon as you become a parent that you give up everything else. I can't imagine what my life would be like if I had had to do that. My parents were phenomenal in that respect. They still let me be a teenager at times I needed to be a teenager. And then I was a parent at the times I needed to be a parent. So oftentimes on the weekends, my mom or my dad would watch my daughter and I would go out with my friends to the underage clubs and we would go hang out. And then I would come home and I would be back in my parent role. I imagine if you have to step into that parent role and just be a parent, there are so many things that you miss. It's the time when you become independent and you figure out what's right for me or what's not right for me or what kinds of choices am I going to make in my life. And if you are automatically put into a situation where you can't figure out those things, I can't imagine what would happen after that. It really is a time where you really figure out who I'm going to be. So I'm figuring out who am I going to be as Anna at the same time as who am I going to be as Olivia's mom. So my parents were great. They let me be a teenager. Other times I was going to school, so I was a student and then I was a mom, and I sort of wore a lot of hats at that time, and I'm very thankful that I had the support to be able to do all those.
So let me ask you about that. What made you decide to take on going to Alverno, getting 2 degrees while you have this young daughter?
So after I had my daughter, I had gone on what was used to be called the AFDC. So it was the welfare system that we had back then. And that was at the same time that everything was being changed and you weren't allowed to just be on AFDC. You had to be going to school. However, the rules said you had to be going to school for to get a degree. It was a 2-year degree at the time. And so I was in sociology at Alverno. And that was a 4-year degree. And they said, nope, you have to drop out of school. You have to get a job because that's a 4-year degree. You can't have a 4-year degree. There was no way that I was ever going to be able to support my daughter for the rest of her life if I wasn't allowed to go to school. I can't imagine flipping burgers for the rest of my life and being able to support my daughter. So I went to Alverno and I said, okay, so I have to have a 2-year degree. What do you guys have? I need a 2-year degree. And so they had piano, pedagogy, and a general studies, which wouldn't have led to a job. And they had paraprofessional. And I was like, okay, that's what I'm doing. Put me in that program. And so I went to Alverno to be a paraprofessional, and I started in the Milwaukee Public Schools. While I was in the Milwaukee Public Schools, and I kept going to school to get my bachelor's degree, because then by that time I was self-sufficient. But it really came down to, I have a child. There's no way I can have a minimum wage job and still do everything I need to do for her and for me. So I have to go to school. I have to get a degree so I can make more money.
How did the positive parenting program help you as you were going through those challenges, trying to ensure not only a good future for yourself, but for your daughter?
You know, it's encouragement. Like, keep going, Anna. We know it's hard. Keep going. You're doing the right thing, which is important for people, you know, to know. Like, no matter how hard it is, no matter how many times I go to bed crying at night or how I had done things, certain things in my life differently, like, keep going. So that was huge for me, is to keep having somebody tell me that I'm doing the right thing, that I'm making the right choices, and that I should keep going, especially not for me, but for my daughter. And then just other times, Rosalie Manor had some really great, like, Christmas parties and things where we would go and there would be gifts for my daughter and myself. So they had events where we could go and get together with other teen moms. And those things were also very important to me.
Did you see other young women struggling without the support of their families like you had had, but being able to get some of that from Rosalie Manor?
I'm extremely lucky. I can't even put into words how lucky I am to have the family that I have that supported me the way that they did. There are tons of teen parents out there that do not have the support that I had with my parents and the rest of my family for that matter. I think Rosalie is critical because it does offer so much of what a lot of our teen parents in Milwaukee don't get. And I work in schools. There's tons of parents that when their child gets pregnant, they're like, get out. You have to leave. I don't want a baby in this house. You have to go. I'm not supporting you. And so where do you go then if you don't have anybody? And so I think Rosalie is really amazing for the teen girls that are in Milwaukee that are in that point where they need help and they don't know where to turn.
I think it's interesting, though, even in your situation, Rosalie, you know, where you did have the support of your parents, maybe your parents weren't ready to have their daughter be a mom.
Very true.
So it kind of provided resources that they maybe still wouldn't even have been able to provide, no matter how many, you know, how much support they gave you.
Right. When I look back at that time, I really can't imagine doing what I did without support from both. As much as I attribute to Rosalie Manor, I attribute as much to my parents, to some of my friends that were around at that time. I mean, I just had a really great support system. There's a lot of people that helped me out at that time that helped me get where I am and still do. I mean, you know, I might be 36 at this time, but I still have a ton of support. Then she can do it too.
Well, let's talk about some of your accomplishments. You obviously worked in Milwaukee Public Schools. You've worked in schools actually all over the world. You just finished as a campus administrator as a choice school in the Milwaukee area. And now you are going on to another big adventure.
I am. I am going to be moving to the United Arab Emirates in August to work in the Abu Dhabi Education Council, the public schools that are in Abu Dhabi. And so right now I'm just in the process of packing up my house and sorting through things that are long old and little pictures that Olivia used to draw me back, you know, 15 years ago and so. So I'm getting ready for the next big adventure.
I just find it fascinating because I feel like a lot of times the message that we give teen moms is, that's it, your life is over. And yet here you are, you've gone on, earned multiple degrees, raised a beautiful daughter, traveled the world, seen the world, and are now going off to this amazing opportunity to teach other kids. Do we often count teen moms out?
We do. We do. I think it's really unfortunate. And I think it goes back to what we said earlier about, like, now that you're a mom, your life is over. And now all you need to do is be a mom. And I think that we don't support moms enough. I had dreams before I was pregnant, and I still have dreams now. And there's no reason why anybody's dreams have to be cut short because of any life circumstances. I don't know if there's enough programs in Milwaukee or enough people doing the things that we need to do for teen moms. I think Rosalie is fabulous and that we've been doing this for so long in Milwaukee. There's so many teen moms that Rosalie has helped, but there are so many more out there. And I wish all of them knew that life doesn't stop. Really, life just begins. I mean, I took my daughter to Belgium, Germany, and Netherlands when she was in the fifth grade. So that first experience traveling, even for her, makes her want to go travel now. It's all those little things that you can do for your child while you're doing things for yourself that really make a difference in the end.
What message do you have for other young girls now in the situation that you were once in?
Go to school. I can't stress it enough. The only way to have a future for you and your child or children is to get an education. Your children will see you reading books and writing papers and on the computer looking up things and going to the library. And in turn, that sort of gets instilled in them. And then they will want to increase their own knowledge about the things that they love. And it sort of domino effects into our children that education is important and that no matter what they want to do in their life, if they have their education, that's something nobody can ever take away.
Anna Hamernick, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Anna Hamernick is a graduate of the Rosalie Manor Community and Family Services Positive Parenting Program and is now on the organization's board. The proud mother of daughter Olivia, she also has worked in education as a teacher and in leadership positions for 15 years, and she just left this month to teach in the United Arab Emirates. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce. You can learn more about the Rosalie Manor and its Positive Parenting Program from links at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, we'll go back 150 years to learn about a book that's collected from letters home to Wisconsin during the Civil War. That's just ahead on Lake Effect from WUWM.
Father, mother, ever dear, I'm your unworthy son. I seat myself to tell you of the ground we have won.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company. The song we're hearing right now is Do Not Borrow Trouble by the Madison-based folk duo Count This Penny. While the tune is original, the words are actually about 150 years old. They're the sentiments of a Wisconsin soldier writing home from the battlefields of the Civil War. That letter is currently housed at the Wisconsin Historical Society's Civil War Collection, and from that vast archive of more than 11,000 letters by Wisconsin soldiers comes a compilation, This Wicked Rebellion, Wisconsin Civil War Soldiers Write Home. It's edited by John Zim, and he joined us last year from Madison and told Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce that these letters had previously been collected and preserved by one Edwin B. Quiner and his daughters during and after the war.
All the letters come from one collection. We call them the Quiner scrapbooks. They are newspaper letters that Edwin Quiner had his daughters clip out of newspapers. See, Quiner was the secretary for the governor at the beginning of the war. And when the war broke out, he subscribed to every paper from Wisconsin that he could. And he and his daughters clipped out the letters that they could find that were written to by soldiers to their families and put them in these scrapbooks. And Quiner later used those to write his Military History of Wisconsin, which came out after the war. So he assembled altogether 10 volumes of these letters. There are about 10,000 to 11,000 of them, and donated them to the Society in 1867.
And so how did you go through these thousands upon thousands of letters to decide which would be included in this collection?
Luckily, these were digitized and put on the Society website in PDF format a few years ago. So I basically sat at a computer flipping through PDFs and reading, you know, all 10 volumes.
Why was it important for you to present the letters from the soldiers as they were written rather than include them in some sort of history that you wrote and then included quotes from them?
The soldiers can write about this in a way that we can't. You know, they didn't know what was going to happen. And, you know, that uncertainty comes through quite a lot. And their own voices, I think, tell the story probably better, you know, than a lot of us, you know, certainly better than I can. You know, they were there, they were involved, they saw all these details that, you know, sometimes we kind of forget about, you know, talking about things like sewing kits and earthquakes. And there's a clipping about living through a flood in their camp. You know, since being there and experiencing it themselves, you know, they read about it, you know, much more personally and, you know, with that uncertainty.
As you were going through and collecting which letters would be featured in this Wicked Rebellion, were there individual pieces that stood out to you, specific details that made you think, oh, yes, this needs to be included?
Yeah. In fact, the second clipping, I think, to me is probably my favorite. It's very short, the second clipping in the book, talking about a husband who is saying goodbye to his family as his regiment was leaving. And his child, who's a three-year-old girl, puts her arms around her dad's neck and starts sobbing and won't let him go. And I have a son who's, you know, a little older than that. And, you know, I read this and I was really affected by it, thinking, you know, what would I do in this same situation? And, you know, those sorts of things that I think that remove the distance between us and the soldiers and, you know, shows they're not that different from us. And that, you know, make us look inward and think, you know, what would I do in this situation? Those really stood out. And also, you know, ones that showed how people, you know, soldiers, and, you know, there are some clippings from women at home who were trying to deal with life while so many men were gone. Accounts that, you know, showed a lot of the situations, the difficulties that they faced that their previous life really probably didn't prepare them for.
There's one great letter I know that kind of admonishes the men who are left behind, the men who have not gone to war, to say, you know, don't look upon these women as they chop their own wood, lend a hand, help them out. And I thought that was so interesting that there were kind of these appeals that, you know, these women were pretty much left behind to do everything.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, a lot of times I've put them in the situation of having to depend on people and depend on promises. There's another letter where a soldier is writing about the poor treatment his wife received trying to get medicine for his child. You know, talking about the promises this one storekeeper had made before the war. Then when it came time to live up to that, he wasn't there for her. You know, he sent her away without medicine for her child. Difficult circumstances for him to try and navigate.
Some of the other really fascinating details that are revealed in these letters are about camp life and what it was like for these soldiers as they were training and as they were waiting to be sent out into the battlefields, you know, some of the boredom and also some of the mischief that they got into. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think I said in the preface to the book that we could have had a whole book of letters that were written while men were on picket duty alone, when they had time to write. Some of my favorite clippings are about that. You know, what do you do when you have all this time on your hands? There was, right from the get-go in Wisconsin, you know, there were troops getting in a little bit of mischief, trying to get alcohol from a brewery in town and getting shot at by the brewery owner. And then, you know, of course, the boredom, or, you know, doing the same thing day after day, waking up, being drilled, having lunch, being drilled again, doing the same monotonous things over and over, you know, really wore on the men.
There's also a great exchange in one of the letters where they're talking about one soldier on picket line who is pretty much across the way from a rebel soldier, and they're shouting back and forth to each other across the way, talking about what kind of food they have, and eventually they go and exchange a newspaper and some tobacco. And I just thought, you know, and they kind of cordially shake hands, and I thought, that's so revealing that these men in certain instances were just men, were just neighbors.
Right, right, yeah. And under other situations, they would have been good friends. And, you know, to go from that to being combatants on another day of the week is, you know, really incredible.
What about the battles? How did the men write about the experiences that they were having once they were actually in the thick of things?
Those really, throughout the clippings, would run the gamut from, you know, very short letters to, like, a soldier writing to his family saying, just to say that I'm okay. A lot of times they didn't want to get into details about the battle, especially if writing to you know, wife or parents, you know, not wanting to worry the family back at home. But then there are others that are, you know, long, very descriptive of what went on the battlefield. One of my favorites is from a doctor who wrote that at the beginning of the war, he wanted to see a battle, and he was, you know, really enthusiastic about, you know, seeing what it was like. After being through one battle, he said he'd seen enough of it to last him a lifetime and never wanted to again. You know, so, you know, there's a big variety in what they would write home about. Another one that comes to mind is after the Battle of Shiloh, a soldier is writing, and he talks about how beautiful the battlefield is, and, you know, how he's sitting on a tree that was cut off by a cannonball. And, you know, to talk about details like that after something so terrible had happened was kind of revealing.
I also found it interesting how the reputation of the Iron Brigade is slowly revealed through some of these letters as they go through the big battles that these Wisconsin soldiers faced.
Yeah, it was really a very short period of time. I was really excited to find that one. There's one clipping where it talks about, you know, Bronner's farm to South Mountain to Antietam, and you know, describing, you know, bit by bit, almost like building a house, how first they stood up to Stonewall Jackson, and then, you know, really made a name for themselves at South Mountain. And, you know, all that took place in about a month's time, I believe it was, in the autumn of 1862.
Of course, some of the most interesting and revealing letters were about slavery and what was at the heart of this whole conflict. And again, the letters that the men were writing home and into newspapers really ran the gamut. Can you talk a little bit about some of the variety in thought and feeling about the slavery issue?
Sure. That was probably, I think, one of the most intense chapters to try and assemble, because Wisconsinites really had a variety of opinions, you know, as revealed in their letters in the Quiner collection. Because just because somebody wanted slavery to end didn't mean that they wanted African Americans living next to them or being equal to them. And so one of my favorite letters in that chapter talks about how there's a soldier who's watching an army of freed slaves following the regular army in Tennessee, and almost has like a Damascus Road sort of experience, where you can feel his mind changing as he's writing about how, you know, these poor people with very little to their names are still yearning for freedom, working really hard to get away from slavery. And he realizes that, you know, under their skin beat human hearts, and that they might have some notions about freedom that were wrong, that, you know, that they would have plenty to eat and it wouldn't be cold, but that they had a really difficult road ahead of them. And it was, you know, I thought it was really powerful, showing how, you know, most of these soldiers hadn't seen a black person before they went to the war. And, you know, they at first were wanting just to preserve the Union, and, you know, coming into contact with slavery really kind of brought the issue to the forefront for a lot of them. There's another clipping where one of the soldiers realizes, you know, hey, the South, their men are out fighting the war and back at plantations. Slaves are planting, harvesting, and doing all this work that's helping out the South. So if for a purely military matter, slavery ought to be ended.
Well, John Zim, thank you so much for coming on the show and telling us about this wicked rebellion.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
John Zim is the editor of the book, This Wicked Rebellion, Wisconsin Civil War Soldiers Write Home, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. He spoke with Stephanie Lecce last year and will give a presentation at Old World Wisconsin this Saturday afternoon at 2, and will also sign copies of his book from 3 to 5. There's more information at WUWM.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break and then meet the cast of Art, the play kicking off the Milwaukee Chamber Theater's new season tonight. Stay tuned for more of Lake Effect right after this. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Would you spend $200,000 on a white-on-white painting? And if you did, how might your closest friends react? The three friends in Yasmina Reza's play Art find out when one of them makes just such a purchase. The comedy won the prestigious Tony Award for Best Play in 1998, and the Milwaukee Chamber Theater's production of it opens tonight at the Broadway Theater Center in the Third Ward. Tom Klubertanz, C. Michael Wright, and Brian Manny play the three friends, and they join me in the studio to chat about the play. Tom and Brian, who play Ivan and Mark respectively, open with a short scene.
Have you seen Serge lately?
No. Have you?
Yesterday.
Is he okay?
Yes. He just bought a painting.
Oh, yes?
Yes.
Nice.
White.
White?
White. Imagine a canvas about 5 feet by 4 with a white background, completely white, in fact, with fine white diagonal stripes, you know, and maybe another horizontal white line towards the bottom.
How can you see them?
What?
Well, these white lines. I mean, if the background's white, how can you see the lines?
You just can. Because I suppose the lines are slightly gray, or vice versa, or anyway, there are degrees of white. There's more than one kind of white.
Don't get upset. Why are you getting upset?
You immediately start quibbling. Why can't you let me finish?
All right, go on.
Right. So you have an idea what the painting looks like.
I think so, yes.
Now you have to guess how much Serge paid for it.
Who's the painter?
Antrios. Ever heard of him?
No. Is he fashionable?
I knew you were going to ask me that.
Well, it's logical.
No, it's not logical.
Of course it's logical. You asked me to guess the price. You know very well the price depends on how fashionable the painter is.
I'm not asking you to apply a whole set of critical standards. I'm not asking you for a professional estimate. I'm asking you what you, Ivan, would pay for a white painting gussied up with a few off-white stripes.
Jack squat.
Right. And what about Serge? Pick a figure at random.
10,000.
Ha.
50,000?
Ha.
100,000.
Keep going.
150? 200?
200. 200 grand.
No.
Yes.
200 grand?
200 grand.
Has he gone crazy?
Looks like it.
And yes, indeed it does. Gentlemen, welcome to Lake Effect. It's great to see you all again, and Tom, to have you on the show. I think
so
it's been
nice
a long time. Yeah,
thanks,
it's
Bonnie.
A long, long time.
Nice
it's always
to
fun
here.
To be here.
It always is great to have you guys in.
And it smells like popcorn when you walk into the building.
Well, we tried to make it very appetizing.
It's lovely.
And it is lunchtime, almost, mm-hmm. as we're doing this. So, yeah. The play is art, and it is obviously about that, but it's really about friendship, and it's really about the three of you and the relationship that you have with each other, and of course, what the art does to that friendship.
Exactly.
So it is such a great play.
Isn't it?
Oh my gosh, it reads beautifully, and I imagine it plays equally as well.
We're hoping.
We shall see.
We're having a great time.
Is this the first time it's played here in Milwaukee?
No, Milwaukee Rep did do it back in 2000.
Okay, but it's been a long time then.
Yes, yeah. That was part of the – our reason for doing it this summer was to give it enough time to need to be seen again.
So what is it about the play that made you say, I want to do this again?
Part of it was the enthusiasm of Tyler Marchant, our director. He has a wonderful love for the piece and a wonderful approach. Design concept, actually very, very, very clever. He's using Mondrian as a jumping off point, and we are the three primary colors that often appear in those paintings. And our set is very stark white. Furniture, props, everything is white or off-white with black lines.
But not white lines.
No. Well, white lines only in the painting.
Yeah, only in the painting. Does the painting make an appearance?
It sure does.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It is the fourth character.
Almost in a way.
More
it
or less,
is.
Yeah.
Yeah. You get to see it, right? Well, very soon. Pretty much on the first page of the play. You
yes.
You get to look at it.
And make your own determinations.
Yeah, that's part of the fun is as soon as the other characters see it, obviously Serge is the character who's bought the painting. But when he reveals it to – I'm playing Mark when I first see it, the audience gets to see it at the very same moment and make their determination. And what's fun about the play – because I think the play more than about art, it's about relationships like you said. But there is throughout the course of the play a way to sort of give a context for appreciating the art too. So the audience may walk away not completely understanding what a white painting is, but it gives them maybe a nudge toward what it could mean and what it could mean if a friend of yours likes it.
And you don't.
I don't at the beginning, no.
He doesn't in a big way.
I was trying to think at the end, do I like it? I think Mark possibly finds a way to deal with it. And more than that he deals with the painting, he deals with the possibility that his friend could buy it and love it, you know, own it and really appreciate it, even though Mark may not have the capacity to fully understand it.
And I think that's what's so interesting about the play is that it juxtaposes the three of you, very different people, but yet friendships that come under this stress that none of you, I think, is expecting. Is that fair?
Yes.
I think so.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a 15-year friendship. We do hear that right in the script. And I do think any friendship has challenges. But these people, we meet them, these three men, right at this crux where they – could go in many different directions. What kind of damage is done? What gets said because of, you know, their misunderstanding? It's a critical time, but I think anyone who has friends will relate to this piece. When a friend makes a decision that you're not sure you agree with, you don't know how to grapple with, you start questioning, as Marx says, what's the tie that binds us together?
And what I find also interesting about this play is that it's not in the context of a romantic relationship. Most of those stressors, it seems, in novels and plays are often around some sort of a romantic connection. This is not the case. This is about friendship and how important those bonds are. And we don't necessarily think about them, I think, as seriously.
Especially for men.
Yeah, it's three men who go through this. And there are times when if you were just reading it plainly, didn't know the names of the characters, that you could see these characters as a married couple or a male-female or a male-male or female-female in a romantic relationship. They talk about things in that way. But it's not that. It's three men who have a deep friendship for each other, and there is a trust that is betrayed, or at least it's felt that it's betrayed. I mean, I have a line where I say, you've betrayed me. I feel abandoned. As far as I'm concerned, you're a traitor. And I could hear a man or a woman saying that to their partner in a romantic relationship.
Yeah, it's like a breakup.
It's intimate.
On the verge of a breakup.
Well, and really intelligent writing. That's the thing that I think is really great. You know, because oftentimes when you see men – friendship between men portrayed – in, you know, movies,
the Hangover.
TV shows. Yeah, it's just, you know, it sort of dumbs guys down a little bit. And I think that's a
really
great
thing. Well,
there's
a lot of back thumping and there's that sort of stereotypical behavior that we think of or we're told that that's how men relate to each
right.
other. And this play completely throws that
it
on
really
its ear.
It really does. It treats them very intelligently. And it's
great language, too.
Yasmina Reza, the playwright, uses repetition of words and phrases in a scene where they just start building on top of each other and they're thrown back and forth in a little bit of a different way until there is a climax of that moment. And it is fun to get in the middle of those words. It's crafted really wonderfully.
Did you find as you were in the rehearsal process for this that sometimes the deliciousness got in the way of finding the truth of who you guys were, or did it really just feed?
It feeds it. Good language feeds the emotions, I mm-hmm. think. If you can ride these wonderful words, if they're well crafted, I do think they feed you.
Yeah, I think
I agree.
I agree. Those words helped us mine what some of the emotions were. So, yeah, it was rich stuff to work with.
So, starting with Tom, tell me a little bit about who you are in this play.
Well, I play Ivan, and Ivan is – he's an interesting
he's
guy.
He's funny.
He's really interesting. You know, Ivan I think is the part of the friendship, you know, if you had to use Wizard of Oz analogies, he's kind of like the heart. He's like the – you know, he wants them, I think, both of them to remember, you know, a little bit of their humanity and what brought them together in the first place. He finds all of this, you know, arguing about the painting just to be kind of ridiculous. And why are we doing that? You know, let's go out and have a good time and enjoy
each other's
company.
But he's pretty
neurotic
too.
Yeah.
He's got his own bag
of trouble. Oh, he's definitely.
Troubles.
Yeah. He's taken up a new job and he's about to get married. So he's under a lot of stress and he's kind of a neurotic guy anyway to begin with. I don't think he
hypochondria.
Handles, yes, a hypochondria. Yeah, you know, he's got his issues. But these guys have always been his kind of his, I don't know, saving grace. You know, I mean, he loves his relationship with them, really enjoys the company that he has with them. And so when he sees them kind of going at each other, I think that for him is a real, what happens if I lose this? So this is a great character to play, really, really, really a fun character to play. And it's neat because I think a lot of times he's sort of in the middle of them. So it's really fun as an actor to play this
I kind this of imagine him with the two hands out kind of trying to keep
it's
him
a great,
apart.
Yeah, it's yeah. a great metaphor. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And yet still dealing with his own neuroses.
Absolutely.
or trying to anyway.
Yes, all the time.
And so Brian, for you, Mark, who's Mark?
Mark is an aeronautical engineer. I mean, it's mentioned in the play. It doesn't really play another role in the play. He's a man who thinks that he knows how things are put together and how everything works. He's a man who it comes out in the play that he feels as though he's been sort of a leader among these three friends. And whether that's true or not, we don't know. But he saw himself as someone who was – he keeps using the word a man apart, that he sets himself away from the crowd and he is his own man. And he feels good about that and he feels that his friends feel good about that too. He's a man who loves classical things and one of them being classical art. And what's fun in the play is when we are at each other's house, you will get to see a representation of what everyone's taste is in the play. So in my house, there is what's described as a Flemish-style painting, a sort of a landscape that has a bit of a frame around the edges of it, and it's very classical looking. And that's Mark's taste. He doesn't know what to do with a canvas 5 feet by 4 that is almost entirely white. Doesn't know what to do with it. Doesn't fit in his scope. So he's a man that's rigid in his views of life and his friendship.
And Michael? Serge?
Serge is a dermatologist. He's probably the wealthiest of the three. And he is taken up with modern art. He is divorced with children. And I think he's really caught up by this white painting because it's this canvas to paint his new life on. He is a forward thinker. And we're all primary colors. We've all been assigned. I'm blue. I'm the cooler character. Brian as Mark is red. And Tom as Ivan is yellow, which is a really interesting assignment for us. But I do think that I understand why Serge loves this white painting. I can totally get that.
Why?
Just that whole sense of, number one, looking toward the future. I think you can paint your own life onto a white canvas, and there's just enough texture in this piece to resonate for you. But I think there's something really, really wonderful about something fairly plain and being attracted to that. You know, that little bit that's there is enough to instill imagination. I think that's what I love about good theater, giving people just enough to spur their imagination, not spoon-feeding. To me, that's what Serge is about. He wants to take chances now, take risks.
He's at that point.
He's at that point in his life, yeah.
And I would say that probably certainly threatens Mark. It's like, wait, what?
Yeah, suddenly Mark sees a friend who has other taste when, again, whether it's true or not, Mark always thought that his friend's tastes in music or art or sports or whatever, food, was sort of channeled through his interpretation or his opinion of – and so when they've spent a little time away from each other and suddenly Serge buys this painting, it threatens the core of what he thinks his friendship is with him.
Well, I can't thank all three of you enough for coming in and giving us a little taste of art this morning. And Break a Leg, best of luck.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Thanks so much,
thank you, Bonnie.
Tom Klubertanz, Brian Manny, and C. Michael Wright star in the Milwaukee Chamber Theater's production of Art, which opens tonight at the Broadway Theater Center in the Third Ward, and it runs through the 25th of August. There's more information about the play and the rest of the Chamber Theater season at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And that's it for Lake Effect today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.